Good morning. I'll make this kind of short and swift and snappy so you golfers can all get out there and hit the course. Want to keep, you know, they sit on their seats like this ready to go. my name is Glenda Lee Burns, and I am a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon. And I've been associated with this program for about 35 years. I'm a slow learner. It's taken me a long time. And you never get through learning. That's why I can never understand people who say, well, I got it and I don't have to come anymore. I would not miss my meetings or my participation in Al-Anon. It's stood me in good stead through my marriage and through raising my kids, and now I'm seeing the next generation, those grandkids, that I can say, oh golly, I can see this one's going to qualify. So you just got to keep your perspective and your sense of humor, and I've learned all that in Al-Anon. I'm going to say this very, very briefly, and some people go, oh my God, you know, here she goes. But you'll see this ties in down the road with who and what I am and what I've learned. I am the adult child of an alcoholic. And for years, I just would not acknowledge that that had anything to do with who and what I was. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was a binge drinker, good, hard-working construction worker. But when he'd get paid, every once in a while, he'd go on these alcoholic rampages. And we just grew up with that yo-yo syndrome that you grow up when you're a kid. You don't understand. See, I blamed my mother for talking back to my dad. And if my mother would do this, my dad wouldn't have done that. And maybe if I was better, my dad wouldn't, you know, drink. He'd come to some of the plays and some of the things we had. So even then, I was trying to rationalize other people's behavior. My dad had the binge drinking, and we had course homework like kids do today. And when you went to school and a teacher said, well, you had all weekend to get that done, you didn't stand up and say, well, I couldn't do it because my dad was smashing furniture and knocking my mother around the house this weekend. You kept your mouth shut, you stuffed it, and you thought, the heck with you. You don't live where I live. And you got kind of a defiant attitude. Now, out of the three children, I'm the eldest, and I'm 8 years older than my brother and 4 years older than my sister. And I would go toe-to-toe with my dad. I remember Christmas Eves when I poured his booze down the drain so he couldn't drink. I also remember a time in my life, and it had to be back when AA first started, in the early 40s, my dad went to a few meetings. I didn't know what kind of meetings they were, but I knew my dad didn't drink for a while. And my fondest memories of that time in my life were walking across the bridge, holding my dad's hand, and we'd go get malted milks. And isn't that strange how that's come back to me later on? For years, I hadn't thought about that. My way of handling my dad's alcoholism was rebellion and defiance. And I'm always amazed when people sometimes will refer to me as a lady. I was not a lady. I have become a lady. When I was 16, I was sent away to a home for incorrigible girls. And I was there for a year. My parents didn't know what else to do with me. They couldn't, quote, control me. And that was a good year for me because I learned I wasn't dumb and that I could excel and I was smart. And I came home from that school, not to a much better situation. My dad still drank on weekends. But I had a little bit more understanding about what I was capable of because I felt less than always most of my life as a reflection of my dad's behavior and my mother's behavior. So, and I would never blame my behavior on my parents. Those were choices that I made. I made my own what I call self-destruct pattern at that time in my life. And it was only later on that I understood some of why I did those crazy things. But it was out of rebellion and out of rage and out of that screw you attitude I had at that time in my life. I came home and I got my act together and I went into nurse's training. I graduated from high school at 17 years of age and I had good grades. And I went into nurse's training. And one weekend, when I was home on a weekend, I had missed a bus. And I grew up in a very small town. And if you missed a bus in my town, there was no way to get where you were going. And I was headed for Cleveland to have a good time. And I was with two other girls. And I thought, well, there's no other way to get there. I'll get out and flag down a ride. So I got out in the middle of the street and hiked up my skirt, put out my thumb. And I had a red DA haircut at that time in my life. And all of a sudden this car pulls up and the brakes screeched. And my God, it was my Prince Charming. There he was. You know, he, that smell of beer and juicy fruit gum, you know, and that turn on. Well, I gave him my number, and my two other girlfriends gave him their numbers, and he looked kind of scrawny and like he needed someone. And being the person I was, I hoped that he would call me. Well, our relationship started on deceit from the very beginning. I did not cook. I was not a domesticated Dora. It was not on my agenda of things to do in life. And but my mother was a fantastic cook. And I invited Tom, he called, and I invited him for a meal. And as he came up the driveway, I said to my mother, quick, tie the apron on me. I want him to think I cooked this. See, I was going to set him up because I wanted him. I just fell in love instantly. And I met Tom in November, and I was just 18 in October, and I met him in November, and I married him in December. Now, part of his lead is his relationship with my dad, so I'll let him tell you that. But to make it easy, anything that would upset my parents, especially my father, is what I did too. And all you had to do was say no to me, and it was the hell with you. I'm going to do this. So my father didn't have good feelings about Tom, because I think my dad spotted it right away that Tom drank. And, of course, my dad didn't want that for me. He knew what alcohol had done to his life and to us, our family life. But Tom and I ran away and got married. And we had no place to live, and my dad had just built this new two-car garage. And the guy pulled the cars out, and they went to work, and they put windows in it, and they put a little bathroom and a little space heater. And we were going to live there until Tom got on his feet. Tom had a job when I married him, but he lost it. That was didn't take him long to do that. And my father, of course, with his eldest daughter, and he loved me very, very much, thought, well, I've got to do something with this guy. So he got him started in an apprenticeship program and a pipe fitting apprenticeship. And we were going to live in this little garage until we had our beautiful home in the country with a white picket fence. Because, see, my life was not going to be like my parents'. My life was going to be different. I had it all pictured up here and how I was going to shape this person in my life to do what I wanted him to do. And I was going to be this perfect wife with this perfect husband, and we were going to have everything that I'd always dreamed of growing up. Sans the alcohol, no alcoholism. Now, I did go out with him and I drank with him. See, this is what we did for dates. We went places, we drank, we danced, we had fun together. That was before the legal piece of paper. Now, after we got the legal piece of paper, we'd go out and we'd dance and we'd drink and we'd have fun, and then we'd have an argument. And then I'd get brought home and I'd get dumped off in the driveway, and he'd leave. And sometimes he'd leave for days, and sometimes he'd leave for weeks. And I would spend my time crying, trying to figure out what I did to cause him to leave. And maybe if I revised my behavior. I became such a fantastic homemaker and housekeeper that I scrubbed baseboards with toothbrushes. I cooked wonderful meals. I did all kinds of things to show him how perfect I was so he would come home to me. Didn't work. He didn't come home. I would try the sexual, you know. He'd have so much sex he couldn't handle it. Then he'd do something and I'd cut him off. He didn't get anything. The constant manipulation of somebody else's behavior. And this is what I thought I had to do as a wife. Well, we had one baby. And then a year later, we had another baby. And between the first and the second babies, and the third baby, we separated. We separated for probably about 3 or 4 months. He was always coming back, and I was always grateful to take him back. But then he'd screw up, and he'd do something again, and I'd have to throw him out to show him that I wasn't going to put up with his behavior. All I wanted him to do was straighten up and fly right. I loved him. I didn't want to throw him out, but I had to prove a point. And, of course, my parents were there to take care of us. He left for a while, and he came back, and we had one of these wonderful makeups. And my third son was born a year later. And I want to tell you, when I was carrying that boy, probably about 3 months pregnant, I seriously considered aborting him. Because, see, by this time I felt so used and abused. I never felt loved. I always felt set up, used, and left. No matter what I did, his behavior didn't change. He still did this crazy drinking and violence. And, of course, I started nagging and yelling and screaming and becoming the shrew. I remember one time when a young couple brought him home, and I was standing on the porch, and maybe I hadn't seen him in a couple days, and this woman pulled in the driveway driving a car, and her husband had Tom in the car. And I stood out in the front porch with the kids screaming, "You paid professional, you know, go back with your..." But I didn't say it in those words, because I had a real, real filthy mouth, too. I had a nasty mouth. And I turned into a very embittered, angry young woman because he wouldn't do what I wanted him to do. And no matter what I did, he wouldn't do what I wanted him to do, which was make me happy. He couldn't do it. After the third boy was born, we did separate for almost a year and a half. I was through. This time I was definitely through. I was always putty in his hands when he came back because I always believed him. But see, I was not going to believe his lies anymore because he always lied to me and he always set me up for the next fall, the next disappointment. Those things I learned too in Al-Anon, great expectations lead to great disappointments. But I always had these great expectations and I always felt so let down. And whenever he drank, he did that to me. He did that to hurt me. I took this all personal. Now, I'll take you back like with my dad. See, my father did these things to hurt us. That was my conception when I was younger. I didn't know how else to think. You drank, you acted like this to hurt your family. And I couldn't figure that out. So I got myself in the same type of situation. Well, Tom and I separated for almost a year, and he went on the wagon and decided he was going to sober up and fly right. Now, he didn't go to any program or anything, but he didn't drink, and I thought, God, he's changed. And I was having a rough time. I had these three little guys all a year apart trying to raise him, and he kind of courted me again, and I, quote, fell into the trap. And we went back together and we reconciled. And we moved away from my mother and dad. Because, you know, by this time, you're not only blaming him, you're also blaming all the people around you. And I didn't like his friends. He didn't like my friends. The community, I felt like everybody knew what a jerk I was. This gal who had this... I hated to go out. I couldn't hold my head up. I felt so betrodden and downcast constantly because I was married to this fool. And you know what? I hated myself for loving him. And I hated myself for going back and playing back into it again. But I didn't know what else to do because every time he told me he wasn't going to drink, I believed him. I wanted to believe him. But also every time he, quote, let me down, which is how I felt, this was working. I got harder and harder. And I was not a nice woman to be around. I didn't have friends. Who wanted to be around me? Tom and I went back together, and we decided we were going to do something to cement this marriage. We were going to have another child. We were going to have a child, all right? We needed another baby like we needed a hole in the head. But this one we planned. And after a little while, I was pregnant, and we had this darling little girl born to us. So we had three boys, and we had this beautiful daughter. And I remember him putting his hand on her head, and he'll say, "Honey," he said, "this little girl will never see me drink. She'll never see her daddy drunk." Well, see, that didn't last long, and he had lied to me again. I just internalized all these hurts. Everything you did to hurt me. Then I had to do something to hurt you. I had to do something to get even. And I remember one time I found out that Tom had had a brief fling. And I decided that I, of course, was, how do you react? You get even. I said I went out and I found out about this and I was crushed. And I got out my best slut outfit and I put it on. And I went to one of the notoriously worst sections of Cleveland and sat on a bar stool. Now, you figure I'm in my 20s, and I'm a fairly attractive young woman, and I didn't have to wait long for somebody to come over and offer to buy me a drink. And I'll never forget it, because this guy leaned over and started to say something, and I went, "Oh, my God, my husband's been unfaithful, and I don't know how I'm going to go on." And, of course, he pulled back, he called back, and once again, I guess somebody was watching over me, because see, this was part of my self-destruct behavior again. You know, I'm gonna destroy myself to show you. And he finally listened to my sad tale, and then he said to me, "Listen, honey," he said, "I'm gonna take you home." And he said, "I'm going to drop you off in the corner of your street because I certainly don't want to come face to face with your husband." He said, "But do me a favor." He said, "The next time something like this happens," he says, "don't go out and ruin some other poor guy's night out." And I said, I often wonder if he went home to his wife too, you know. But I went home, and I went home defeated, and that was one more hurt that I could store away, you know, this unfaithfulness, what he had done to me again. And the daughter was born, and we ended up moving back out to Avon Lake, and I, of course, lived in my penance that this man had been sent to punish me for previous sins. That's why he was in my life. And my duty was just to suffer and be a bitch. I mean, that's how it was going to be. And we started to remodel a house, and, of course, he wasn't going to drink again, and he went out on more drunks, and I became just this terrible, nasty person. Because, see, I wanted him to make me happy. And it wasn't until years later that I realized that I contributed a great deal to the debt we were in, to the mess we were in. Because, see, now this is where my dad comes back into this again. When Tom would go out and drink, I wanted Tom to prove that he loved me. And how do you prove that you love somebody? You buy them things. You buy them things you can't afford, and you put it on charge accounts, and you go to loan companies, and you do all these things to prove that you love me. This is what my dad did. He'd go out on these binges, and then he'd be in such remorse, which I understood after I come into Al-Anon, that he'd go out and he'd buy us things. We had wonderful bicycles, and I had cashmere sweaters, and I had all these things that most kids whose dads are construction workers don't have. My dad lived in a constant state of remorse, and he was always trying to make up to his family what he did. Well, I wanted my husband to do this. You know, prove you love me. So he'd go out and he bought me a black cashmere coat with a white mink collar. And we got, I think my grocery budget at this time was $20 a week. You know, the insanity. And I accepted these gifts because I deserved them. He had hurt me. He had to make it up. He had to show me. He had to prove that he loved me. Then, of course, he was such a liar. It only lasted. He set me up again, and then he dumped me down. And I went from, they laughingly say, you know, I went from this superior, this ultrally superior woman who knew everything about everything, and you couldn't tell me anything, just an adequate woman who just couldn't function for herself and couldn't do anything for herself. and I'd want him to take care of me and make me happy. During this time, we bought a house on land contract, and because we didn't have good credit, and that was the only way we could get a house. And the house was like a little old remodeled cottage, and he was always trying to do things to make me happy. But by this time, man, there was no way. Nothing he did was going to satisfy me. And he started to dig a basement under this house, and he started to do some remodeling. And he went out on another drunk, and of course everything laid, nothing got finished. And I found out about a meeting in Avon Lake. Now, I didn't even remember AA, my father being there, but I heard about this group of people that didn't drink, and I told my sister, because she had also married this alcoholic, but he was better than my alcoholic. He wasn't violent. He was just a nice old drunk that didn't go to work and that. See, everybody had it better than I had. I lived in a state of envy and jealousy that was unbelievable. And just everybody I envied, I hated them, I was jealous of them because everybody had what I didn't have in life. And this is the kind of a person I was at this state in my life. I also was not a nice person to my children. There were times that my kids could have used my comfort, my help, and I'd push them away, go away, can't you see I'm worrying, I'm busy, I'm going to go out and get him, I'm going to do something to him. I planned his death. We had a railroad track not far from home, and he'd get home and he'd pass out in the driveway in the car sometimes, and I thought, you know, if I could get that car, if I could push him over and drive that car to the railroad track, then get back to the house. And how sick I was is I stood in front of the mirror and I practiced how you would look if somebody came and told you that your husband was dead. You know, the right expression of shock, of total, oh my God, you know. But knowing that I had done this, because that was my only way out, was to kill him. I remember standing over him one day. He was in the bathtub. He had been gone like on a 3-day drunk, and he come home. Didn't say a word to me. Didn't even say he was sorry. Come in, got in the bathtub. He's laying down, nude. And I come in with a claw hammer, and I stood over him. And I want to tell you, I think the only thing that stopped me from swinging that, and I had him nailed. I mean, I could see his toes curling up in the bottom of that tub. He didn't know which way to go. And I thought, no, if I swing and I don't hit him hard enough, he's going to get out of there and kill me. And then I thought, no, my children deserve more than this. They at least deserve some type of a parent. So I finally walked away from him. I put down the hammer. If there had been a gun, I probably would have killed him. I probably would have walked in and shot him. So I know the state that you can get yourself into. I was in a constant state of rage and despair. And there was no way out, either his death or mine. And I tried mine a couple times too, made half-hearted attempts at that. At this point in our lives, we had bought this house. The brother-in-law was an alcoholic. My sister was divorcing him. And we had a friend who was a judge and a lawyer, and he said that he would give us the 2 divorces. And we'd only have to pay for one because he had to do the same paperwork. So anyhow, we directed the fellas to AA. And, you know, some woman came and called me on the phone and said, my husband is going to be your husband's sponsor. And she said, I'm in Al-Anon. And what's that? Well, that's for the wives. At that time, it was mostly wives that went. And, you know, it's a support group for wives. And I thought, well, fine, I'll go and I'll learn how to keep him sober and make him do what I want him to do. Because I still had plans. We were living in this gutted out house, and I wanted him sober, and I wanted him working on that place to get it done, because I still had this picture, this ideal life I was going to have in my head. Well, he went to AA, and he went with the brother-in-law, and he was sober about 4 months. And I went to these meetings, and never once thinking that I had any problems. My whole problem was him. And if he'd straighten out, our lives would be great. Well, about 4 months down the road, he had a chance to go out to South Dakota and make some money. And I'll never forget, his sponsor called me and he said, Glenda Lee, don't let him go. He says he's chasing fool's gold. He hasn't even got his feet on the ground. And I thought, what do you know? You don't know anything about how I've lived. You don't know anything about how I've sacrificed. You don't know anything about how we don't have anything. And I want mine. He's sober. I want, and the only way we can do this is with money. So I encouraged him to go to South Dakota. And he left probably in March. And he got out there and he called me. And when school was out, I took the children and went out. And when I got there, I found out he had been drinking. And he had started to drink after he called me and told me to come out. I was still doing him a favor by loving him, by being with him. And that attitude certainly showed on my relationship to him. I had no respect. I had nothing but contempt for him and myself for being in the situation we were in. I went out to South Dakota, and sometime during that fall, he got picked up for DUI, and they told me to come in and get him. And I shouldn't have gone. I should have known that, no, you let somebody pay the price for what they do. But anything I'd learned in Al-Anon, I hadn't absorbed. It certainly didn't apply to me. I just went and sat on the chairs and listened to all these other stories. And I went in and I got him. Now what I did is I left my four children alone in a farmhouse. And I figured in my mind 45 minutes, 30 minutes in, 30 minutes back, and he'd be captive. And he could listen to me rant and rave and tell him what an SOB he was, what a louse he was, and how he'd let us all down again. And you know what? My plans got kind of shook up. My car went off the road. I was blinded. I got out of the car. My eyes froze shut. I remember crawling around, and I fell down in a gully and saying, you know, dear God, not only am I going to die, but my children, they're alone in this house. He's in jail, and I'm out. I'm going to die in this storm. And all of a sudden, a truck pulled up, a fuel truck, and I remember the men pulling me in and trying to scrape the snow off my eyes so I could see, because they had froze shut and from the tears. And he took me into town, and he told me, he says, we can't turn around. The roads are impassable. If you can get a ride back out, you know, lady, that's going to be your problem. And I did find somebody to take me back out. That was the first glimmer of light that not only was I destroying myself, but I could have destroyed my children. I packed up and I left him to his drinking, and I came back to Ohio. And this time I was resolved. I was about 26 years old, and I was not going to live like this anymore. And he came back, and for the first time in my life, I shut the door in his face, and I actually told him to keep going. See, I had gone from the point of love or infatuation, lust, to the point of hate, and now I could look at him and I felt nothing. I mean, it was just empty. I looked through him like he was a door at the end of a hallway. And he went to New York and he called me and he needed help, and I let him come back. It was a long story. I didn't do it because I loved him. I did it because I was greedy. I needed money. In other words, I was willing to prostitute myself to support my family. And he came back home, and there was a violent scene, and I had him locked up. And I didn't drop the charges. Now, there'd been violence before, but I always dropped the charges because I always thought it was going to be different. And this time, we went through with the prosecution, and boy, I had him. I had a hammer over his head. You lay a hand on me again, fella, and you're going away for a long time. And I want to tell you, I didn't let him forget it. He went back to AA, and of course, I didn't believe that anything would ever be different in our lives. I went to Al-Anon, and I sat. I remember that I always did the right thing because I wanted you to think well of me. I remember being secretary, and because I heard an old tape where I was introduced as a co-secretary, and my sister and I went, and we were these perfect women who had married these SOBs, and you know what? He started getting better. And he started working a program, and I could see a change in him, and I didn't like it. It changed for these people. He still wasn't doing what I wanted him to do, which was get busy and make this perfect world for me that I wanted. And I told you that I was one of these, you know, you do it, helpless type people, waiting for somebody else to always do something for me in my life. And time got better, and I didn't realize how sick I was till one day I come up out of this basement that we had gutted, and we had the open 2x4s with the insulation in between them, and we were just scraping by. We were really in debt, and we had nothing. And I come up the basement, and I got to the top of the stairway, and I looked down, and I realized I was all blood. I'd punched every 2x4 coming up that stairway. And I didn't feel it on the way up. It wasn't until I got, because see, I didn't feel too much of anything anymore except anger. And I looked at my hand, and I thought, I am one sick cookie. I am really sick. And I think that's the first time that I realized that how full of rage and hate and frustration I was. I started to go back to my meetings. We started to work together a little bit. And you know, little by little, things came. And little by little, I found out I could do things for myself, that I was talented, that I could hang wallpaper, that I could paint walls, that I could refinish furniture I dragged off of tree lawns. And you know what it was? It was change of attitude. And attitude, instead of poor me, it became, gee, I wonder what I can do with this, or I wonder how I can fix that situation. I started to develop an attitude of gratitude for what I had, not what I didn't have, because believe me, we didn't have a lot. And my house wasn't the most important thing to me. His program became very important because I realized finally without his sobriety we wouldn't have anything, and that had to come first. And I started letting up on him and on myself, and we started to work together and kind of build a life. Now when our oldest son was 18, he told me what I could do with my Al-Anon program. Put it someplace where the sun wouldn't shine and there'd be no rainbows, believe me. And I realized that that was another spiritual awakening. You know, God speaks to us through people, and sometimes he speaks to us through things that aren't so great. And our oldest son left home, and he joined a cult, and we couldn't figure out what we had, quote, done wrong. And because weren't we this wonderful sobriety family? And me with almost 8 years of Al-Anon, 10 years of Al-Anon at that time, and Tom with his sobriety. And it jolted the both of us back into a new awareness, and it jolted me into a search for spirituality. I had a program, but I had no spirituality at all. I worked the basics, but I had no God in my life. And his rebellion sent me on a quest, and I found the God of my understanding, a guidance, something I could believe in. So I thank him. When you look back in retrospect, and when you want to say, why God? And then you find out, so you could do this with what's happened in your life. That son did leave the cult after 3 or 4 years. Today he's a wonderful 44-year-old man who has a lovely family and has absolutely no problems and is one of my best buddies. And there was a day he'd walk by me in a hallway and spit on me. So that was said a lot for my Al-Anon program, didn't it? The kids got older and things got better for Tom and I, and some of the material things started to come. And the second oldest son, yeah, he'd go out at night and he'd come home and he'd sit on the bed and he'd talk away and just be so loose as a goose, right? And this was our next alcoholic. And Chris, of course, didn't really realize that he had a problem. I think he realized it earlier because of his dad's program and because that we didn't get in his face about it. Although I will tell you a cute story. One time he was in a bar and he had won a great deal of money on a lottery ticket. And Tom was upset with him. You know, Tom didn't have Al-Anon, so he got really upset with him. So, And he was going to go down and drag this kid off the bar stool and tell him, you know, just exactly what he thought was going on in his life. And I started laughing, and I said, "Oh, my God, Tom, you know, you need Al-Anon. You can't do this." And number two, the fact, aside from Al-Anon, is this kid's 6'5" and goes about 240 pounds, and I don't think you want to fool around with him when he's drunk. So one day Chris came to the house, and he was drinking, and he had this horrible look that my dad used to get, and like Tom got when he drank, that violent look in his eyes. And I did what's probably the hardest thing for any mother to do. I told him I loved him very much, but if he ever came to my house drunk again, I'd call the police and have him locked up. And I meant it. I told him that I did not deserve to be frightened and afraid of my own son. He left. He didn't go right out and join AA, but it wasn't shortly after that he made his decision. In the meantime, his sister was 23, and Corrine had gone to meetings with her daddy her whole life, and she went to a meeting and she heard a woman speak, a woman in AA, and she came home and she said to me, "Mom," she said, "I didn't identify with the way she drank, but she drank." She said, "But God, I identified with her ups and downs, her emotional roller coasters, the depression, all the stuff that went with it." And she said, "You know, I don't want that in my life anymore." She says, "I think I'm like my dad." And I thought, thank God, you know, I've been wanting to tell you, but I wasn't going to tell you about it. So she went into AA, and then 6 months later, her brother came into AA. And Tom and I, our lives just became great. They had a business, and our home was getting finished, and it was just a perfect life, and we thank God for all our blessings. And then in 1985, we took Corrine to Florida with her job. She had a wonderful job, and she traveled. She did Coca-Cola promotions and went all over and got a chance to meet all kinds of people, and I'll have to tell you, people from Memphis. This is one of her favorite places. This was where she told me she always wanted to go back to Memphis. She loved that blues street and all that stuff there. And I went to meetings there and met people, and would come home and tell us about all the wonderful places that she had been and all the wonderful people in AA that she had met and how wonderful it was to have family. Wherever you went, you had family, even when you were away from home. So we moved her to Florida in 85 in May, and we weren't home 10 days, and we got a call that Corrine had been murdered. And you know, that perfect world falls apart, that life that, you know, aren't we blessed? Hasn't God been good? Where was God? Where was God now? You put one foot in front of the other, and you keep doing what you've always done. Keep on keeping on. And I had problems holding on to my sanity. And my husband will tell you in his lead where his trip took him. And no, we did not cling to each other. We were both in such pain, we could barely stand to be near each other. We went that way. And we had to have our own experiences this way before we could come back together this way. But meanwhile, those footprints, when you think God has deserted you, he's there. He's carrying you, because that's what carried us through probably the next 4 years. And as a result of Corrine's death, my life took a different path. I work in advocacy, which is part of practicing these principles in all our affairs. And I have found that that's been part of my healing experience, is to be an advocate. But 4 years, 3 years after Corrine's death, Tom was falling apart, and I could see it, and there was nothing I could do about it. Now, I didn't worry about him having a drink. I worried about him losing his sanity. And guys were out on a golf course, beautiful day like this. And I came home, and my husband told me to get out of the house. And believe me, I left. I could just see this in him. And I thought, where am I going to go? I said, my son's on a golf course. And I said, God, you know, smiles on you. Because any, you guys know, you go up and you play 18. No, who gets a ticket for 9 holes, right? And you're out in a golf course, you could be in the back nine. And I pulled in that parking lot, and those guys were walking in on that front nine. And my son took one look at me and said, "Mom, what's wrong?" And I said, "Your dad needs you." And he and the other three AAs that were with him packed those clubs up, jumped in the cars, and came down to the house and took Tom and enfolded him in only the loving arms of AA. And our son at this time had about 5 years of sobriety. And part of Tom's story is how Chris helped him back. We eventually, and I will tell you, I'd be a liar if I told you I'm over my daughter's death. But I can, pain is a lot of, when somebody told me that I would get through things, I didn't believe them. And I stayed here and I found out it, you do. And when I tell you about unfaithfulness, or I tell you about poverty, or I tell you about how we lived, I take that trip mentally, but I don't take it emotionally anymore. I've let go of the emotion and the hurt and the pain that went with all that past, and I never thought I could let go of a lot of that. And I can talk about my daughter's death today and know that out of that has come a terrible amount of good also. I have been able to be of service to a lot of people. That never would have happened if I hadn't lost a daughter. The awareness that pain gives us, how aware we are, other people that are in pain. And you can reach out a hand and say, "I understand." The young women that have come into my life, so many young women in my life, it's like, you know, Corrine moved out and left this vacuum, and all these other people have come in. And I take that as a privilege and a joy. I may not have even been aware of other people if she was still here. The joy we take with our grandchildren and our family. The fact when I tell you that I would go to my AA, to my Al-Anon meetings and to his AA meetings and sit on the chairs and feel like screaming. But I kept on doing what I had been doing for like 25 years. And little by little, life has joy again, and life has meaning, and life has beauty. One day at a time took on total new meaning to me, believe me. I live today. I live like in the joy. I get up, and isn't it a glorious day? And I owe all that awareness to this program, because from that bitter, impatient, selfish young woman, my mother had the opportunity to say to me, I had been nursing her through an illness, and she said, "Where did you ever get the patience?" And I said, "That's not me," because she raised me. I said, "You know, that's the result of my program. That's what I've learned. You accept the things that you cannot change, and you change the things you can, which is yourself. And then you have to have the wisdom to know. And life is life. Life is going to hand us ups, and life is going to hand us downs. And it's our attitudes. And as long as we keep that attitude of gratitude for every day, we can handle anything that life hands us." The man that I, at one time, felt nothing for, the man that I felt hatred for. We laughingly, we used to call ourselves the battling Burnses. We'll meet the blissful Burnses today. This man is not only my lover and my provider, but he is my friend. He is my person that I laugh with, that I take joy with, that I know was sent into my life not to punish me, but to maybe take my hand and lead me down the road. And I'm forever grateful for that now. Isn't it funny how this turns your whole perspective of looking at life and takes it and turns it right around 180 degrees, and then you go, "Oh, now I understand." I understood my father, and that was a blessing too. I had a wonderful relationship with my dad, an understanding of my dad before he died. just so many blessings that this has given me when I learned to accept. And it was not a fast journey. Believe me, I did not come in this program and get this overnight. I have backslid and I have started over and tried to figure out how I screwed up again. And that's why I say every day is a new day. We get up and we can fix anything that we did yesterday by starting today and living it to the best of our ability. I want to thank you for having Tom and I here. This has been a spiritual experience, Juanita. Not only the rainbows, not only the mountain, because you can have this anywhere, but the people that I have met, the old friends, the new friends that are in this room. I am so grateful, and it's not a fleeting gratefulness. It's a gratefulness that stays within the heart. Thanks a lot.